Our first case is United States against Prince. This is a certified case. Counsel for the government, you may proceed.
Chief Judge Efron, judges of the court, may it please the court, I'm Captain Chad Fisher, and along with Major Amber Williams, we represent the United States. The evidence in this case shows that the accused knowingly and voluntarily waived his rights under Article 31 and voluntarily elected to make statements to CIA. Therefore, this court should find that the statements made by the accused to Special Agent Owens are admissible for three reasons. One, the accused's first statement that he had sex with PFC Sig is admissible because Special Agent Owens did not interrogate the accused. Two, the accused's second statement, the partially exculpatory statement, is admissible because Special Agent Owens sufficiently advised the accused of his Article 31 rights. And finally, the accused's third statement is admissible as a subsequent confession because it was voluntary under the totality of the circumstances. Now, going back to the accused's first statement, the law in this area is fairly clear. The question for the court is whether Special Agent Owens interrogated the accused when he asked, "Why are you here?" An interrogation includes any formal or informal questioning in which an incriminating response is either one, sought, or two, a reasonable consequence of such questioning. And to determine whether any particular question rises to the level of interrogation, this court has said that we must look to the context of the question. And looking at that context, the issue in this case is really about the objective prong of that test, whether it was reasonable. And in this case, an incriminating response was not a reasonable consequence of the question, "Why are you here?" Just simply looking at the video, this was really the first set of questions that Agent Owens asked of the accused. He was rolling around in his chair, had not sat at his desk, did not have a pen in his hand, and asked, "Why are you here?" He had not conveyed any information about the case to the accused. He did not lecture the accused, so this is distinguishable from a case such as United States versus Byers, which the accused...
Which way does that cut, counsel? He's lolling in his chair. Couldn't that be equally interpreted as a way of putting the accused at ease and eliciting something from him? You're saying it would have been a different case if he'd been sitting there like this?
Well, what I'm saying, Your Honor, is that this test really focuses on the perceptions of the accused, obviously. And looking at this through the eyes of a reasonable accused, they would not interpret this first
A reasonable
question.
Accused going into a place, okay, you got to talk to CID. Okay, why are you here? I guess there's a couple of responses. One is, well, I'm here because da-da-da-da-da, like this accused did. One is, I don't know.
One of the responses, too, Your Honor, might be what you just said, which is my command told me to come here.
Yeah.
There's no dilemma here. He can answer this question truthfully without incriminating himself. So is it possible that the accused might say something like this? Yes, it is possible, but the question is whether or not it's reasonable.
Is the test whether any non-incriminating response can be given?
No, Your Honor, it's not. But again, the fact that he can choose to answer this question truthfully and not incriminate himself, again, takes us out of that dilemma or the cruel trilemma situation. But again, at the end of the day, this Court and the Supreme Court have said that in evaluating this test or looking at using this test, we have to be mindful of the purpose underlying Miranda and Article 31, which is to prevent or to thwart attempts by law enforcement to circumvent warnings requirements through subtle conversations. And we simply don't have that here. And we don't have that here because we know the very next thing from the video is that Agent Owens reads him his rights twice. And that brings me to the second statement and the second issue, which is whether or not Agent Owens adequately advised the accused on the nature of the accusation. Again, this court has said in Pipkin and Simpson that the accused must be informed of the general nature of the allegation to include the area of suspicion that focuses the person toward the circumstances surrounding
Counsel, I'd like you to refer to page 6 of your brief.
Yes, sir.
You said the very next thing he said was that he warned him of his rights. And on the brief, it suggests, "Before we start, I need some administrative information." And then he says, the investigator, you've always stated that you're here because you had sexual intercourse with someone.
Yes, Your Honor.
So what we have there, is that a warning of rights or is it a repetition of the incriminating statement made by the accused?
It was that, Your Honor. Again, he was confirming, I think, why he was there. But if you look at the timing, Your Honor, at 4 minutes and 20 seconds.
So he was there because he'd had sexual intercourse with an individual? So he was confirming the incriminating statement?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, again, I don't want to speculate exactly as to what his subjective intent was at that point. But from a timing perspective, at 4 minutes and 20 seconds is when the accused makes his incriminating response. At 5 minutes, a minute later, he's being advised of his rights. And then about
he's being advised of his rights after the interrogator has confirmed the incriminating remark.
Yes, Your Honor. He confirmed the incriminating remark and said, yes, that's why you're here, and you don't have to say anything about that. So again, I think those two statements right there, I think, go to what this court said in the Simpson, which is the purpose of advising an accused of the nature of the accusation is to orient him to the transaction or incident under investigation. And when Agent Owens said that, yes, that's why you're here, you don't have to say anything about that. He knew, the accused knew, he didn't have to say anything about the sexual encounter with PFC Sid at all. There's no question here that he was oriented to the incident under investigation based on that initial rights advisement.
Well, did he say that you're here because I suspect you of this particular offense, or did he say you're here because you said you had sexual intercourse? Or is he's confirming why the person believes they're there.
Yes,
is he saying why the government has asked them to be there?
No, Your Honor, he didn't. But again, I don't see where the law says he can't use the accused responses as part of his rights advice. And that's essentially what he did here. He confirmed with the accused why he believed he was there and said, yes, that's why you're here. You don't have to say anything about that. And again, he got that twice within the first, I think, 14 and a half minutes of the interrogation.
What do you make of the military judge's finding that viewed objectively, it appears he is avoiding the use of any criminal term for the conduct the accused was alleged to have committed?
I don't think it factors into the analysis, Your Honor. I don't see how Special Agent Owens' subjective intent is relevant in determining whether or not the accused was adequately advised. The question is, was the accused oriented to the nature or incident? And it's clear based on
the accusation.
Nature of the accusation, yes, Your Honor, which this court in Simpson and Pitkin has said the purpose is to make sure they're oriented to the transaction or incident. And he was here.
Is the military judge's finding of fact in that regard a statement as to the subjective intent of the interrogator, or is it an objective analysis by the military judge of the facts that are before him as it might be perceived by the person being interrogated?
Based on that language, Your Honor, I'm not sure that it's a finding of fact at all. It sounds more like speculation as to what the military judge thought. If he's going to make a finding as to what Special Agent Owens' subjective intent was, then I think that's going to receive deference from this court and couldn't be overturned unless it was clearly erroneous. But if he's going to speculate as to what Agent Owens may have been doing, then I don't think that this court owes any deference to that.
What if it's a statement as to what a reasonable person would perceive based upon an interrogator behaving that way, if from the perspective of the person being interrogated?
Then that's his conclusion of law, Your Honor, which this court would review de novo.
Why is that a conclusion? Why is that a conclusion of law? That is, the judge at that point wasn't saying that I conclude at that particular point in the judge's writings, was not saying I conclude, therefore. He was describing a particular set of historical facts.
I think that particular statement, Your Honor, and I don't have it in front of me, but I think that particular statement kind of walks a fine line between the two. And I think it could go either way, okay, as to whether or not that's a finding of fact or conclusion of law. But at the end of the day, Your Honor, even if the court disagrees with the government on the first two, I believe that the government's strongest case is really on the third statement. And that statement was admissible as a subsequent question because it was entirely voluntary under the totality of the circumstances. Again, this court has made clear what the test is. It's reviewed de novo, and this court looks to the characteristics of the accused and the details of the interrogation to determine if the accused's will is overborne. And looking at the video here, the accused's will simply was not overborne. nor was his capacity for self-determination critically impaired. And I believe there are three facts that really support that. The first is that the accused was advised of his rights to counsel and silence twice within the first 15 minutes, and despite that, he chose to continue to speak. And the Supreme Court in Elstad said that is highly probative of voluntariness. Second, at no time did the accused appear confused. Did he ask for clarification, or did he invoke any of his rights? And third, he was never threatened, intimidated, or promised anything in return for his statement. Now, again, I think Elstad should really be the starting point here. And in Elstad, the Supreme Court said that a subsequent administration of rights should suffice to remove the conditions that precluded admission of the earlier statement. And that's essentially what we have here. And the military judge's analysis on this point is flawed, really, we believe, for two reasons. First, he relied on factors or circumstances that the Supreme Court has said are not very probative of voluntariness in the failure to warn context. And second,
which particular factors did he rely on that the Supreme Court would preclude him from relying on?
The Supreme Court didn't preclude him from relying on any of these, Your Honor. The Supreme Court has just said that certain factors in the failure to warn context are not particularly probative. So, for instance, the cleansing statement. In Elstad, the Supreme Court stated that a cleansing statement is neither practicable nor constitutionally required because, in many cases, you don't realize that there was a breach of Miranda or a breach of Article 31 until long after. And this court in Brisbane actually applied a very similar analysis and said, hey, listen, the police didn't realize that there was a bad Article 31 rights advisement, and said, this court said, our analysis is therefore going to hinge on other factors.
And did the military judge err in finding 22 and stating that that was the holding in Brisbane and that he took that into account?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I couldn't hear your question.
Did the military judge err in finding number 22 when he stated what I believe you stated as the holding of Brisbane, and he took that into account in assessing the totality of the circumstances?
I don't think so, Your Honor. And again, I think the real problem with the military judge's analysis, in addition to what I was just saying there, I think the real problem is when you look at that second paragraph of his findings, it doesn't match up with his legal paragraph that comes right before it.
So he cites paragraph 23.
Yes, Your Honor. He cites the proper legal standard. But then when you look at his analysis looks like he's looking for attenuation instead of voluntariness. So again, the things he's looking for, he cites the six-hour continuous interview. That's not necessarily probative of voluntariness. And the Supreme Court said that in Elstad. They said when you're looking at an actual coercion case, yes, a break in the sequence of events, a change in the interrogators, a change in location, those are all probative of determining whether or not the taint has carried over. But we don't have that here. What the defect in the first two statements, if you will, has been cured with the rights advisement. So again, that ties into this court's and the Supreme Court's case law that says, hey, listen, we don't presume taint. This is a fresh look at the third statement. Now, the kind of going backwards here, and I apologize for that, but there was one additional factor, Your Honor, that I'd like to highlight as far as what the military judge relied on that's not very probative. And he relied very heavily on the fact that Agent Owens used the first two statements or the admissions from the first two statements to obtain the third. And I believe that those should be given very little weight for two reasons. First is, those prior admissions did not stem from a complete failure to warn. He had been advised of his right to counsel and silence twice at that point. So it's not as if we are in a complete failure to warn situation. And second, during those first two statements, the accused did not let the cat out of the bag. So there's simply not the same level of moral or psychological pressure, if you will, when he goes into that third statement. It's not as if Agent Owens knows everything he needs to know at that point.
Well, and Owens didn't put R-A-P-E on the sheet for an hour.
That's right.
The accused wasn't owning up. Now, what way, how does that cut? Doesn't that indicate deception on Owens' part?
Well, Your Honor, we don't have a finding of fact from the military judge on deception. So I think, again, the court can look at the evidence anew. And Special Agent Owens explicitly testified in the record that he was not deliberately hiding the nature of the offense or the word rape from the accused. He explicitly testified to that.
Well, then what was to prevent him from writing it again if he wasn't deliberately hiding it?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. I don't know the answer. It could have. It was not the smoothest CID interview. I think that's clear from the video. But again, the question is not whether or not it was perfect. The question is whether it was legally sufficient, particularly on the third statement. Again, just looking at the video, at no time was Specialist Prince's will overborne.
What's the standard review here?
For which one, Your Honor? For which statement? The third statement?
Isn't this an evidentiary ruling, and this is suppression of evidence?
Yes, Your Honor.
Over abuse of discretion.
Yes, Your Honor, except for the three critical legal issues in this case, which is whether 31 rights were required, whether he was sufficiently advised, and whether a confession is voluntary. These are all reviewed de novo, Your Honor.
Counsel, with respect to the first statement, I take it from the government's brief that you don't take issue with the military judge's conclusion that Special Agent Robinson's knowledge was imputed to Special Agent Owens so that he was a suspect?
Correct, Your Honor. We're not challenging his findings on the suspect issue. And just one final point, Your Honor. I see I'm running very low on time. This court said in Bubonics that the totality analysis does not mean a cold and sterile list of isolated facts, but rather is a holistic assessment of the human interaction. And again, looking at this case, looking at the interaction between Special Agent Owens and the accused, his will was simply not overborne. His confession was voluntary and should be admissible as a court martial. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. You have a further opportunity on rebuttal. Counsel for the defense.
May it please the court, I am Captain Macready, along with Colonel Mark Teletochi. We represent Appellee Specialist Michael Prince. The Army Corps correctly affirmed the military judge's ruling to suppress Specialist Prince's statements to Special Agent Owens for three reasons. First, the initial sequence of questions from Agent Owens to Specialist Prince constituted interrogation. Second, Agent Owens failed to inform Specialist Prince of the nature of the accusation until 1 hour into the interrogation. And finally, the government cannot meet its burden of showing that Specialist Prince's third statement was voluntary under the totality of the circumstances. Turning to the first statement, the government essentially argues that the response was not a reasonable consequence of a question. However, this argument ignores the fact that different suspects provide different responses given human nature, as some are more open, upfront, and direct than others. And in this regard, the question was not an administrative question, such as, can I get you something to drink, or do you know where the restrooms are? But instead, the question went to the substance of the case, because Specialist Prince would only be at CID for a crime that he was either a witness, a suspect, or a victim to. And even the facts in Pipkin demonstrate that it's a reasonable consequence for a soldier, a suspect, to know why he is at CID answering questions. And finally, the test is not the most likely answer, but what is a reasonable consequence, a reasonable possibility of the question. Now, the government next argues that in the context, it was simply a first set of introductory or icebreaker questions. However, if you look at the deliberate sequence, the first question was, do you know why you are here today? To which the response was, yes, sir. Then the second question being, okay, why are you here today? That deliberate sequence demonstrates that the first yes or no response was done, and so now Specialist Prince has to make some sort of factual assertion or disclose some information, whether he has to answer honestly or play dumb, as some other suspects do.
Counselor, are you suggesting that the motivation of the interrogator is at issue here? I didn't see that in the military judge's findings.
No, Your Honor, and I would say the subjective motivations or even his subjective actions, such as twirling around a pen or playing in his chair, is irrelevant because the test is objective in that you look at what the reasonable consequence is. So his motivation is irrelevant. What he was doing before, during, or after bringing Specialist Prince into the room is irrelevant as well. Turning to the second statement, whether Specialist Prince was properly advised of the nature of the offense, the government essentially will argue that sex conveys an appropriate frame of reference or oriented the accused to the transaction. However, the problem is that sex by itself is not an offense, is not a crime, is not even wrongful conduct under the UCMJ.
Well, fornication isn't an offense under the code, but he's just blurted out, I'm here because I had sex with her. And then he says, well, we're talking about what you just said. How much plainer can you get? Do you have to, have we ever said we have to, you have to advise him of the statutory cite to the, you know, rape article? Or, so it's obvious what they're talking about. Why isn't that enough?
I would disagree that it was obvious, Your Honor, because sex by itself is not wrongful conduct. So if you take the government's argument to the...
You're in CID and you're talking about sex. Why would you be in CID and talking about sex if there wasn't some imputation of wrongful conduct?
What might be the nature of the accusation is not rape. For example, how might somebody infer? Well, so you know they're talking about whatever occurred in the room. Now, in response...
At the very least, Your Honor, it should be put on notice of some sort of sexual conduct or sexual assault on the date in question. Because if you just take the argument that sex alone was appropriate, then in the future, the government would only need to bring in a person and advise them, instead of drunk driving, just advise them that they were driving. Or instead of advising them of making a false official statement or communicating a threat, they would just advise them of making a statement. Similarly, instead of wearing unauthorized insignia, they could just advise them of wearing insignia. And to answer your question, Your Honor, it's not clear that the focus was on the illegality of sex, because it wasn't until 60 minutes into the interrogation that Agent Owen said, you know, old girl wasn't with it. And that was the first time he put on notice that there are aspects of his conduct that could be criminal or wrongful or unauthorized. And if you look at the meaning of accusation in offense in the statutory language of Article 31, Black's Law Dictionary defines accusation as a charge of criminal wrongdoing and offense as a violation of law, a crime. And so if you take the legal meanings of those two words in the statutory language, it requires law enforcement to refer to some sort of crime, wrongful conduct, unauthorized practice, etc. And this makes sense because knowing the nature of the offense is critical when making your decision to exercise your constitutional right. And frankly, it's the reason why Agent Owens admitted on JA 129 that in the civilian world, you don't advise of rape or burglary because it can have an adverse effect on obtaining incriminating statements.
If this took place at the Academy at West Point, and a person acknowledged that they had engaged in sex, would that orient them towards an accusation of involuntary sex or rape?
It possibly could, Your Honor. There might be rules and regulations such as the school honor code that maybe prohibit relationships, sexual relationships among cadets. So that could possibly, in that context, lead one to believe that they're sufficiently oriented to a crime. However, that's different from this situation.
The crime or the crime of rape?
It would be oriented to a crime in violation of an honor code, Your Honor.
But isn't there a difference between being oriented, a big difference between being oriented to a honor code violation involving consensual sex and being oriented to a honor code violation involving rape?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's why it depends on what the follow-on facts are. But maybe it was a consensual relationship that violates the honor code as opposed to an unconsensual situation where the person is passed out from alcohol. And that's why it's really critical, and what the statutory requirement is, you inform the nature of the offense so that a soldier who's conditioned to obey and respond to authority figures can make an educated decision whether he should exercise his or her rights. Now, turning to the third statement, because the government believes that is their strongest argument, several factors about Specialist Prince and the interrogation itself indicate its involuntariness under the totality of circumstances. The first point, and what the military judge relied upon, is the characteristics...
Can I go back to the previous issue?
Yes, sir.
It seems that in its raw form, you might say, is one advised of the nature of an accusation if one is advised that it has to do with having sex? Yeah, there are other factors, any facts pertaining to this particular case, in addition, that might inform this issue, or is that just the basic question?
That's the basic question, Your Honor. I know the government in their brief refers to the fact that before going to CID, the accused may have had a conversation with a specialist, Ramsey. However, there's several problems with relying on that. One, the government has the burden and never introduced or brought Specialist Ramsey to testify at the motions hearing. Number two, it doesn't make sense from a policy standpoint to say that an accused has been properly advised of the rights by a battle buddy back at the barracks versus a law enforcement agent.
So does that mean, in light of your statement, that that's the core issue? Does that mean all the extra stuff in paragraphs 17, 18, and 19 is just gratis? And we should just not worry about that and focus on the pure question as to whether sex equals nature of accusation? That's how I interpret your answer, because you don't seem to rely on anything in 17, 18, or 19.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's your question.
At its core, the statutory requirement is to inform the accused of the nature of the offense. And our belief is that sex, because it is a component element of an offense, is not even wrongful conduct in itself, that does not meet the statutory requirements.
Does the record establish whether the alleged victim in this case was or was not married?
The record from the materials contained in the joint appendix indicates that the private C was married at some point, but had divorced and had gone back to her maiden name.
Does the record reflect whether the accused in this case knew whether she was or was not married?
The record indicates that they were close co-workers, however, not friends, not acquaintances that would talk and visit one another, so I don't think it comes out one way or the other whether the accused definitively knew she was divorced at that time or not.
So does the record reflect whether, in this case, the question that elicited an answer about sex and the further discussion about sex would have oriented the accused as to whether the offense under issue was adultery or whether it was rape or some other form of involuntary sexual activity?
It does not, Your Honor. If you look at the facts as known at 1200 hours of 14 April 2010, it's not clear whether he knew that or not. And of course, that goes in, the nature of the offense goes into calculus, because if it was merely an accusation of adultery, certainly a suspect may feel more inclined to speak with a law enforcement agent because it's typically a misdemeanor, versus in this case where the accused faces 30 years and a dishonorable discharge for aggravated sexual assault, he may be more likely to seek the assistance of an attorney given the steep penalty he could pay.
Let's focus on the third.
Yes, Your Honor.
On the third statement.
Yes, Your Honor.
The government has emphasized that in this case, applying Supreme Court standards, the third statement would be, even with the errors alleged in the first two, admissible because of the totality of the circumstances and the will not being overborne. Is that the standard that you apply in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. The appellee would agree with the standard put forth by the government, and the appellee would point out to you several characteristics of Specialist Prince himself and factors of the interrogation, such as no time lapse between statements, the fact that Specialist Prince was not given renewed and adequate rights warnings, the fact that he was questioned by the same individual in a law enforcement station house, the fact that there were not cleansing warnings administered, which is a problem when you rely on previous statements and obtain a subsequent statement, and finally, the questionable law enforcement conduct present in this quick case, and I'll address each in turn. First, the military judge relied upon Specialist Prince's characteristics in making his decision. The fact that he's a 22-year-old junior enlisted soldier with less than 2.5 years of military experience at that time, with a low GT score, only a high school graduate, and brought to CID by a section sergeant. If you contrast Specialist Prince with the accused in Chatfield, Gardner, and Brisbane, you have quite a contrast. In Chatfield, you had a 36-year-old officer with 12 years of military experience and even had experience with the UCMJ because he had subordinates investigated for crimes. And also, Gardner and Brisbane, you had two E6s with over 10 years of military experience. So certainly, that finding supports the military judge's findings. Turning to the fact that there was no time lapse between questioning periods, Specialist Prince immediately went from the first hour of the interrogation into the subsequent hours of the interrogation. So he had no time to weigh the pros and cons of continuing this talk, unlike the accused in Brisbane, who had a month and a half in between statements. Now, Specialist Prince was not given renewed and adequate rights warnings. If you look at the videotape, One hour into the interrogation, he was not given the choice to stop. Instead, and I'll quote the language from Special Agent Owens, he says, you have to sign that one because you're suspected of having knowledge of it. She's saying that she's not with it, so she's saying you're suspected of having knowledge of it. That's why you're here talking. So I need your signature, your initials right there. So Agent Owens has not given him a choice to continue in the interrogation or not. So 60 minutes into the interrogation, he had two prior deficient rights advisals. Then you come to this point where he's commanded to initial next to rape, and they just plow forward. Because if you look 1 hour, 12 minutes, 20 seconds into the video, Agent Owens states, okay, this is the process where I pretty much write down what you've already told me. Then he gets out the computer and they type it up, just what he said. So again, there was no renewed and adequate rights warnings in this case, unlike the government position.
Is that the position of the military judge in this case?
The military judge concluded that there was prior rights advisals, and this is the one aspect where I believe that that was an erroneous.
Has the defense appealed that?
The defense has not.
So what's the law of the case then?
Then the judge's finding in that case stands. But even if you take that view.
And is there any reason under DOS or our standards under law of the case that we would overturn the military judge in that regard?
I'm not sure, Your Honor.
So why is the defense arguing it then?
Well, even if you take that out and say there was a proper, renewed, and adequate rights warning at that stage, you still have other factors, such as the fact that you have the same questioner who continued to question the accused in the law enforcement station house for an additional 5 hours. And again, this isn't just any CID agent. As a military judge found, this was an experienced agent with substantial training in interrogation techniques and tactics. But the biggest factor, Your Honor, is the fact that there was not a cleansing warning administered. And this hurts the government for the same reason it does in Phillips, because Agent Owens relied upon, used, and bootstrapped previous unwarned admissions in making, getting the incriminating statements later on. For example, the method of entry, whether it was the front door versus the adjoining room, the level of intoxication, Special Prince was unsure at first versus the final admission of being incapacitated, whether Privacy was awake before, during, and after the sex. At first, she was awake and looking at him, and then he admitted that he was not sure because he was not looking at her eyes. And even if you look 1 hour, 55 minutes into the video, Agent Owens catches Specialist Prince. In his first hour, he said he was going down to check on Private C. However, 1 hour, 55 minutes into it, he changes it and says he was going to go down for a shot. And that's where Agent Owens says, wait a minute, you told me X before, now you're telling me Y, which one is it? So the military judge's findings that Agent Owens used and bootstrapped previous statements and getting incriminating statements is supported by the record and is not clearly erroneous. And finally, I would point to the fact that the military judge found that Agent Owens consciously and attempted to and never did use the word rape into the interrogation. And that is a finding of fact that's supported for several reasons. One, this was Agent Owens' first military suspect interview. And of course, by his own admission, he was surprised and flustered when he got the response. And so when you're a little bit out of your element, it's perfectly reasonable for you to revert back to your civilian tactics, that is, not informing the person of rape or burglary, so they continue to talk. And certainly the military judge was there, observed the videotape, observed the demeanor of Agent Owens, and that finding is entitled to, is credible before this court. And certainly it's not in keeping within the congressional intent of Article 31 for CID agents to play word games or hide-the-ball tactics, especially since soldiers, young junior enlisted soldiers, are by their nature conditioned and required to obey law enforcement
counsel,
authorities.
Counsel, with all respect, that sounds like an inconsistent argument. At the one point, you're suggesting that that the interrogator may have reverted to his civilian tactics because he was flustered. Now you're suggesting that he was playing hide-the-ball tactics and doing things deliberately, matters that were not found by the military judge. So what's your position in this case?
Your Honor, there's no question. We're not advising that Agent Owens was acting intentionally. I'm just simply stating that as the interrogation unfolded, he may have reverted back to his civilian practice, his civilian Mirandis or modus operandi, even though his intent was not to. Just because, again, he had 10 years of experience, by that point it becomes a habit of using a tactic.
Yeah, but you're saying he's a very experienced interrogator, and then the next And then you're turning around saying he's a boob.
No, Your Honor, I'm saying he's an experienced interrogator, and as an experienced interrogator, sometimes you go back to your bread and butter naturally, even if you aren't even thinking about it.
Well, if you're an experienced interrogator, wouldn't that carry over, and wouldn't the fact that the accused blurted this out not necessarily unhinge you?
Well, Your Honor, again, I would point back to the fact that his subjective experiences in dealings with other suspects doesn't answer the mail as far as whether interrogation, whether it was a reasonable consequence.
What does the record establish as to how many interrogations he had conducted under the UCMJ?
Under the UCMJ, this was his first military suspect. He had previously interviewed 5 to 7 victims of sexual assault, but never any suspects. This was indeed his first one. In the final calculus of the third statement, the government cannot shoulder its burden of showing that the statement was made voluntarily and not a product of the earlier unsworn statement. And for this reason, I see that my time is about to expire. If there are no further questions, I'll simply state that the Army Corps correctly affirmed the military judge's ruling to suppress Specialist Prince's statements.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for the government, do you have a rebuttal?
Yes.
Counsel, if you could, with respect to the third statement, is your argument that the military judge applied the wrong law? Is your argument that the facts that he found were clearly erroneous? Or is your argument that he should have reached a different conclusion?
My argument, Your Honor, is that the military judge erroneously applied the law.
And in what respect, precisely?
Precisely, Your Honor. He cites the correct legal standard. He cites the correct legal standard in paragraph 22, citing to Bustamante and Brisbane, but his analysis doesn't match up with that. His analysis looks like he's looking at the factors that are relevant and probative to attenuation and not necessarily voluntariness. Now, again, attenuation...
You say in your brief, his analysis is essentially presuming taint based on the first two supposedly unworn statements, and that's the error of law that you identify. But paragraph 22 says that the court recognizes that the precise opposite.
Yes, Your Honor. Again, I don't disagree with that, and I understand your point. Again, I think paragraph 22 is correct in citing the legal standard. But then his analysis looks like he's doing a coerced interrogation analysis. He's looking for things that show that the first and second confession, whether or not they tainted the third. And that's not the correct analysis. The question is whether or not the third is voluntary. So, again, can attenuation be probative of voluntariness? Maybe, but they're not interchangeable. And if his end state is attenuation, then the government believes that that would be incorrect. His end state should be voluntariness. If I could just turn to a couple of the factors that the accused noted. He said some of the things that bear on voluntariness in this case are no time lapse in the same individual conducting the interrogation. Again, the Supreme Court in LSAT addressed that and said, yes, these are relevant and probative and coerced confessions, but not so much when you're talking about failure to warn. The defect was a failure to warn, and the warning creates the clean slate, and it should be viewed as such. I already talked about the cleansing warning in my opening, but again, the accused also compared this case to Gardiner, and I think there's an important distinction between this case and Gardiner. In Gardiner, the accused testified. And he said, I felt as if I had no choices. I felt as if I told the CID everything they needed to know. We don't have that here. Again, the accused only made exculpatory statements. And again, they're simply not the same amount or type of psychological pressure when all you've done is revealed what you believe to be an exculpatory statement to the police. And finally, Your Honor, going to...
Did I understand you to say that a failure to warn is cured by a warning?
Yes, sir.
Is that what you're saying? But what if you've already blurted out stuff when you didn't get your initial warning?
I think it's separate analysis, Your Honor. If the first...
You may reach the judgment, hey, I've been had, it's too late, I might as well go with it.
Well, Your Honor, I think in Elstead, Your Honor, the Supreme Court said simply because he doesn't know the consequences of his statement, that doesn't vitiate voluntariness. So I think in this case, again, we look at the third statement in its entirety, and the facts here are fairly similar.
Are you suggesting we shouldn't look to see if the third statement is derived from the first two?
No, Your Honor, I don't think that's the analysis. I think the third statement needs to be analyzed alone.
So you don't think that the voluntariness or the coercion with respect to whether it exists or does not exist with respect to the third statement is determined in any way, shape, or form by earlier statements if they were unwarned?
No, Your Honor. I'm not making an absolute statement of law. Like, what I'm saying is,
so you don't think that that someone with an AFSAP score of 85 that comes in and from as best they can tell from the form is just going to chat with the CID agent about events might not think that the cat was out of the bag?
No, Your Honor, I don't think that, and I don't think we can speculate as to what the accused thought because he didn't testify. But as far as the GT score goes, I mean, I think that that's marginally relevant in this case. It's not developed on the record. The military judge did not make any specific findings on intelligence. And as you can see from the interview itself, from the videotape itself, at no point did he ever appear confused. At no point did he ever invoke his rights. He was offered 12 separate breaks for water, food, and soda. Several times, Agent Owens told him, "Don't let me put words in your mouth." And he was advised of his rights several times. And based on those facts, Your Honor, the government believed that the third statement is voluntary under the totality of the circumstances.
The problem, counsel, is that this is coming here on an interlocutory appeal from an evidentiary ruling where the military judge ruled in favor of the accused, right? And so we have to look at everything in the light most favorable to the person that won below.
Yes, Your Honor, I don't disagree with that. The military judge's findings of fact were not be overturned unless they're clearly erroneous. But again, this is a de novo review, and the court can take a fresh look at the video for itself and simply see that his will was not overborne. I see him out of time, Your Honor.
You'll have the opportunity to briefly conclude if you'd like.
Again, Your Honor, I would just, I don't want to repeat myself, but again, this is not a cold and sterile list of facts, and I want to try to avoid that. When you look at the video here, his will was simply not overborne. He was relaxed. He knew exactly why he was there, and his statement was voluntary.
Thank you, counsel. We thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. The case is now submitted, and the court will be in recess until 10:20 a.m.
Court stands in recess until 10:28.